I'm pretty convinced that one of the most traumatizing things you could possibly experience in childhood is finding yourself being stuck as monkey in the middle. All right, monkey in the middle is a cruel game, right? Because two people are having guaranteed fun at the expense of one person's misery. No one likes being stuck in the middle. You guys know what monkey in the middle is, right? I'm not that old. Okay. It's when two people are on the outside throwing a ball and the person in the middle is trying to get it, trying to get out the middle. You know, in elementary school, I was notoriously unathletic. And so whenever I played monkey in the middle, chances are I would wind up in the middle. And I remember a particular instance, the recess bell rang. And you know, that's the best time for a kid in school. We run outside. I grab two friends. Let's play monkey in the middle. I'm like, oh, it's going to be so fun. I start off on the outside. My first throw, caught. I'm in the middle. And so I'm in the middle struggling. I'm trying to catch the ball. I'm watching my two friends having the time of their lives. They're laughing. And I'm just like, I want to get out of the middle. I hate being stuck here. And so I'm trying and trying and trying. I'm like, how much time is recess? I'm trying, and then I hear the recess bell ring, and I realize I was monkey the entire recess. And it was the saddest realization when I walked back into the school, into my classroom. I was monkey all the time. Now, maybe you've never been monkey in the middle like I have. Maybe you weren't notoriously bad. Maybe you were always on the outside. I don't know. Maybe you've never been monkey in the middle, but I would bet that all of us know what it's like to feel stuck. To feel stuck in our lives, stuck in the mundane cycle of mediocrity, stuck in the breakneck pace of work life, stuck in the feeling that everything is meaningless. And we struggle to get ourselves out of the middle because we just don't know how. You know, this week I had no idea what I was going to preach on today. My mind is kind of all over the place with baby coming into our house and just, he's like a tornado. He's just changing everything. It's really great, but it's really tiring. And then Krista sent me this random email from John Tyson's mailing list. He's a pastor in New York. And I read it, and something about the email sparked my heart. And the email starts with John, this pastor in New York, talking about a movie he saw recently called Living. Living is a movie that tells the story of an ordinary man, Mr. Williams, whose passion and joy for life are slowly ground out one day at a time by the boredom of a meaningless and mundane job. Does that sound familiar? His vision and his passion suffocated below a life of predictability and reason. But one day, everything changes. He goes to the doctor, and he's diagnosed with a terminal illness. And he has this kind of awakening and realization in the film that he has forgotten what it means to live. And so desperate to feel something before he passes away, like anything, he withdraws half of his life savings, and he heads to a beach town known for its hedonism and escapism, right? Kind of like San Francisco. And he meets a local character known for his expertise in the shadier side of town, you know, kind of like, I shouldn't name anyone here. And upon talking to this person, this sage, this guide into a life of hedonism and escapism, he has a moment where he lets out this quiet plea for help. And this is what he says. I withdrew this cash to live a little, but I don't know how. And this is often the unspoken cry of so many people today. I want to live, but I don't know how. We do know how to show up for work. We do know how to pay our bills. We do know how to check off our to-do list. We do know how to suck it up and do what's expected of us. But for so many of us, we don't know how to truly live. We don't know how to find joy in the everyday. We don't know how to feel the pain that we have medicated and repressed for so long. We don't know how to celebrate with full abandon. We don't know how to mourn the things we have lost. We don't know how to tap into childlike wonder. You know, we often forget why Jesus came. Jesus didn't just come to forgive us of our sins. Jesus didn't just come so that we could get to heaven after we die. Jesus came to give us life right here, right now, in this lifetime. You know, we say this all the time. Jesus didn't come to make bad people good. He came to make dead people come alive. And this is the good news of the gospel. I want us to look at John chapter 10, verse 10. Jesus is speaking, often as he does, words of wisdom. And he has this to say. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. But I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. How many of y'all were like punk teenagers? I was such a punk teenager. Like, I went to youth group and acted holier than thou, but on the outside world, on the street world, like, I was a punk. And case in point, you know, I grew up here in San Francisco. We were eating at a restaurant in Japantown that still exists. I won't name it. And we were eating ramen. Okay, I might have narrowed the choices. Me and my friend were eating ramen in Japantown. And, you know, we're enjoying the meal, and we finished the ramen, delicious, still delicious to this day. You guys should go check it out. And then the bill comes, and I look at my friend. I'm like, hey, you want to split this down the middle? I only have cash. Here's my portion. What do you want to do? And my buddy, he got this, like, twinkle in his eye, and I could tell something mischievous was about to go down. And he gives me this look. He looks at the bill. He looks at me, and he gives a stupid grin. And the next thing I know, he's running out the front door without having paid. And I'm left with this bill. And, you know, this was before the days of Venmo. I'm old, okay? This is the days before Venmo. I didn't even have a credit card back then. All I had was cash, and I only had enough for my portion, barely. And so I wasn't thinking, but in a moment of freaking out, I ran out the door after him. And so both of us dined and dashed this restaurant in Japantown. And, you know, every time I go now, I tip very generously. I'm trying to pay back what I've stolen. But we run out, and my friend is laughing. I'm like, why'd you do that? But inside, I'm like, oh, that was kind of exhilarating. I can't believe we did that. Whoa. And we're like, what? We just did that. But then I hear something off in the distance, and I look. And one of the waitresses, who was a middle-aged woman, was running at us full speed. And I was shocked. Like, you know, I didn't know she could throw down that quick. She was running quick for her age. And so me and my friend, we look at each other and we start running. And, you know, every time I drive through Japantown, I remember I ran down those streets being chased by an Asian middle-aged woman from that ramen restaurant. And so she's chasing us, and she has good cardio. Like, we're running for a good amount of time, 2-3 minutes. We ran down the hill, Japantown. We ran up the hill. She's chasing, like, 2 teenage boys in our prime. She's after us on our heels, but finally we got away. But I'll never forget the look on her face, the look of righteous indignation and rage that she had because 2 punk kids stole ramen from her shop. Now, why do I bring this story up? It probably doesn't tie in really well. I just want to tell you the funny story. But when I think about the face of this lady, I think that this lady was more upset about a punk kid trying to steal a bowl of ramen than some of us are about someone trying to steal our lives. The Bible says there is a thief who has come to steal, kill, and destroy. And some of us just aren't upset enough. Some of us aren't pissed enough that someone is there trying to steal our lives. Someone trying to destroy our lives. And here's the thing that we misunderstand about the devil. We think Satan's plan to steal, kill, and destroy our lives is through big scandal or moral failure or like life-threatening illness. But it's actually much more subtle than that. Satan's strategy is to slowly grind you to death over time. To kill your heart day by day in the sludge of the mediocre and the mundane, to subtly chip away at your soul until you are left completely numb and completely empty inside. And it doesn't just happen in a moment. It usually happens over many moments, seemingly insignificant, inconsequential moments, but they add up until one day we find ourselves asking, just like Mr. Williams did in the movie, what happened to me? How did this become my life? You know, one of the unfortunate regrets that happens when you have a baby is your dad bod transforms into a dad bod. And it was crazy because, like, you know, I had Zion. When we had our first kid 2 years ago, like 6 months passed, you know, we finally got him sleep trained and I had my nights back. One day I was like just brushing my teeth in the mirror and I looked and I could not recognize the person in front of me. I was like, I aged in 6 months more than I had all 33 years of my life. And I look like my dad and I gained some weight. I'm out of shape. I'm like, how did this happen? I'll tell you what, it didn't happen overnight. It happens slowly. In the same way, the strategy that the enemy has for stealing, killing, and destroying our lives is a slow grind. Have you ever gotten to a place where you asked yourself, how did I get here? I used to be so full of life, so hopeful, so joyful, so optimistic. I used to be able to dream and hope without coming back down to reality. I used to be so much more fun, so much more loving, so much more radiant. What happened to me? But the good news is this, that wherever you're at, Jesus offers you an invitation. And this is it. Come alive. I have life in all of its fullness to give to you. But here's the problem. We have a bit of a translation issue. When God talks about life and when we talk about life, we're often not talking about the same thing, even though we're using the same word. For example, Pizza Hut means something totally different in Korea than it does here in the States. Right here in the States, Pizza Hut is kind of on the lower echelon of the pizza hierarchy. I don't know if that's a hot take, but it's definitely on the lower echelon of the pizza hierarchy here in the States. It's commercialized fast food pizza. It's rarely the first idea that pops in your head when you think about first date. Oh, first date, Pizza Hut? Most people aren't thinking that. But in Korea, did you know that Pizza Hut, low-key fancy? Pizza Hut, it's a nice sit-down restaurant that you come with your family or your loved ones, and they serve you gourmet pizza. They got the sweet potato baked into the crust, cheese baked into the crust. It's almost like fine dining. At least it was 10 years ago. I don't know how it is today, but I remember being struck by how different Pizza Hut was in America than it was here in the States. Right? Pizza Hut sounds different to an American than it does to a Korean. In the same way, when we think the word life, what we think life is actually not the same thing that God says life is. When we talk about life, what we're often talking about really is existence. I'm alive, I'm breathing, I'm existing. But when God talks about life, he's often talking about something much more. Come on, how many of you know that Jesus didn't die on the cross for you and I to merely exist? For us to be mindless zombies autopiloting through the work week, for us to be disengaged and rarely present in our relationships, for us to be numb and apathetic and joyless and hopeless. No, Jesus died to give us life, to restore our hope and our joy, to resurrect our dreams, to bring color back into our world, to help our hearts feel again. That's the life that God is talking about, and that's the life that Jesus is offering. But the question is this, how do we enter into this life that Jesus promises us? Because like Mr. Williams, we always say, I want to live, but I don't know how. I want to suggest to you that we need something to snap us out of our apathy and our numbness. French philosopher Simone Weil, she once wrote, there are only two things that pierce the human heart. One is beauty, the other is affliction. A real quick graphic, I stole this from John Tyson as well. Life takes place on a continuum between beauty and brokenness, between heartache and joy, between beauty and affliction. But all too often, we end up stuck in the middle. Next graphic, please. Are they up there? Yeah, there we go. We end up stuck in the middle, too afraid of pain and too practical for beauty, too busy to sit with our emotions and too busy to pursue wonder. And so we stay in this place called the middle. And the middle is this place of duty, a place of obligation, a place of expectation, a place of reason. And the language that we often use here in the middle is, you know, I should do this. I have to do this. I need to do this. Or this isn't practical, so I shouldn't. Or the never ending, maybe later. And then later just becomes more later until there's no more later and life is over. And here in the middle, our hearts are managed. They're safe, but they're rarely moved. And I think most of us, it's right here in the middle where the enemy slowly steals, kills, and destroys us day by day, grinding us down into mediocrity and numbness. But here's the sad thing. We actually love the middle. You know, it's not like Monkey in the Middle where you hate it and you want to get out. We actually love the middle. Why? Because it's safe here. It's comfortable. We don't have to get our hopes up and risk disappointment again. We don't have to feel too deeply and risk getting lost in our sorrows. It's safe. It's predictable. We're protected from life, but we're also cut off from life. In the middle, we may be safe, but we're not truly living. You know, C.S. Lewis, in talking about love, but I think it pertains to what we're talking about with life, he once said this: there is no safe investment. To love or to live at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The alternative to tragedy, or at least to the risk of tragedy, is damnation. The only place outside heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and perturbations of hell, of love, is hell. And more few words, he's saying the middle is like hell. You're safe, but you're not really living. The parts of yourself that you open up to love and to beauty and to wonder is also the thing that's open to pain and heartache and brokenness. But when we close it, we're not able to experience anything, neither beauty nor affliction. And so we're not really living. You know, I know in the church we love to talk about balance. Right? We say it all the time, balance between word and the spirit, balance between faith and works, balance between the dark side of the force and the light side of the force. Just kidding, that's Star Wars. But the gospel, when we're talking about this, actually calls us to move out of the middle and to move toward the edges, to move toward beauty. If we could get to the next graphic, to move toward beauty through wonder, through delight, through defiant joy, which is joy in the face of unfavorable circumstances, through gratitude, through whimsy, through risk, exploration, and play. But the gospel actually pushes us out of the middle to also move toward affliction, right? The gospel never tells us to ignore our quote-unquote bad feelings. It also causes us to sit in our grief, to feel loss, to face illness and depression and suffering and separation, addiction, and need. And when we look at the life of Jesus, Jesus never lived in the middle. He always lived on the edges. Jesus lived with defiant joy in the face of difficult circumstances. He stepped out boldly in faith, believing for the impossible. He lived in delight and wonder of the goodness of the Father. But at the same time, Jesus also moved toward affliction. He grieved when his best friend died, even though he knew he was going to bring him back to life a few minutes later. He entered into the suffering of the cross for the ones that he loved. He sat with people in their loss and in their need. And what I want to propose today is Jesus is waiting for us to come and follow him to the edges, out of the middle that traps us in a cycle of lifeless living, into life in all of its fullness. You know, for my son Zion, there is no middle with this little boy. Like, people ask, is he a happy baby or is he a fussy baby? And we always tell him, he just feels everything deeply, right? When he's happy, he's so happy. And when he's frustrated, he is hella frustrated. There is no middle. You know, we were really inspired by Rocky and we were trying to teach Zion how to scooter. And so we got him the exact same scooter that Rocky has. And so he's been learning slowly, but he can't quite understand that he needs to put one foot on and push. But yesterday, I took him to the Great Highway, and I got some Andytown, nice day, went to the Great Highway, closed off, open stretch of land, and he picked it up. He was like, scootering. And I was like, oh my God, wait, I forgot your helmet. Oh my God, this is a hazard. But he just kept going. And so he's scootering. And I tell you what, the delight and the joy on his face, unrestrained happiness. He was like, ah-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha. I was like, are you happy? He's like, happy, happy, happy. But at some point, you know, he's moving in one direction and we're like getting really far from our car. And so I'm like, all right, Zion, we got to turn around. You can still ride your scooter, but we're just going to go in the other direction. And for some reason, this set him off. And one moment he was like, happy. The other moment he's like, ah! Like crying at the top of his lungs. I could not console him. I'm showing him, look, do the same thing, but just that way. He's like, no, no, no. And I've never seen him more frustrated or mad, literally in the 2 years of existence. This is the most frustrated I've ever seen him, just because we couldn't scooter in one direction. We just needed to go back. And so I have to pick him up while he's crying. He's getting tears all over my shirt. He's like wriggling, and I'm carrying his scooter and I walk all the way back to our car. We went like half a mile, I kid you not. And I'm carrying him back. I'm like, dang, there is no middle with this kid. You know, one of the joys I've experienced in parenting is relearning how to live through my children. Children know what it means to live on the edges. They haven't yet learned what it is to be stuck in the middle. They haven't yet learned to be bogged down by duty and expectation and responsibility. They know what it means to move towards beauty. They know what it means to feel the anguish of affliction uninhibited. And I feel like we can learn a lot from that. And so my charge to you today is, let's move toward the edges, to move toward beauty. And some questions that we can ask ourselves as we do that is, how can I create space for wonder and delight and joy in my life? What are some risks, right? Some of us are so risk averse, but what are some risks of faith that I can take in this season? How can you practice the practice of gratitude and incorporate it into your daily rhythm? How can you make room for exploration and play in the middle of your busy schedule? But also, I want to challenge us to move toward affliction. How can you create space in your life to allow yourself to feel grief and loss? You know, some of us have gone through major transitions and we haven't grieved yet. As an Enneagram type 7, I am notorious for this, where, you know, my core motivation in life is to avoid being trapped in cycles of pain at all costs. And so I don't allow myself to feel any quote-unquote negative emotions until it builds up so much that one day it just catches up to me and I spiral like randomly once every blue moon. And, you know, a lot of people transition. I was talking to some people about this, like, you know, Jacob and Jamie moved away, Seabell moved away. I have yet to grieve that. And one reason why I'm excited for this month and a half to go on paternity leave is I just want to create space for grief and loss. You know, some of us, we've gone through transitions in life and we've been trained to just say, it's just life, it happens. But actually, the gospel invites us to embrace our grief and our loss, to create spaces where we can feel it. What does it look like to make peace with the suffering that you're experiencing, knowing there's not much that you can do? How can you face your depression, your addiction? How can you identify and articulate your needs in this season? Hello, Enneagram type 2s. Sometimes we're so bad at saying what we need, articulating it to the people we love because we feel like we're going to burden them. But how can you identify, articulate, and meet your needs in this season? And so as we move toward the edges, we'll find ourselves experiencing this life that Jesus promised us. But I want to end with this. I actually want to take it a step further because, you know, Western Christianity is so hyper-focused on the self, on the individual. But the kingdom of God has always been about family, about community. Romans 12:15, Paul says, rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. How many of you know that sometimes the best way to escape the apathy and the numbness of the middle is to enter into the joy and the pain of others that are around us. As we move beyond ourselves, we find our hearts coming alive. I went through a funky season when I first started pastoring. I was doing a lot of ministry work, and I felt what I'm describing here. I felt like I was stuck in the middle. There was no beauty. There was no allowing myself to feel pain. I was just there in that middle gray space, the icky space, the ick space. And one of the things my pastor counseled me with is like, if you find yourself stuck there, why don't you try going outside into the sanctuary and praying for someone? Like, that sounds like more work. It's like, just try it. Move beyond yourself and what you're experiencing. And so I went out there dragging my feet like, oh, pastor duties, got to pray for people. Just kidding. I love praying for people. But that day, I was not hyped to pray for people. And so I went up to someone. I started praying for them. And I was like, oh, I got a prophetic word, praying that word over them. And, you know, afterwards, I prayed for that person. I felt alive. Like, it was weird. When I moved beyond myself, something inside of me lit up. And I think God's designed us in such a way not to ignore what's going on inside of us, but when we actually move beyond ourselves and move towards joy and beauty and also the pain of others, we actually find ourselves coming alive. And so what does it look like to enter into the beauty of others? It could look like celebrating and delighting in the lives of those you love. Oh, you got a promotion? Let's go celebrate. Oh, you went dragon boating? Let's celebrate that too. Whatever. It looks like expressing your gratitude for a particular friendship. I'm so thankful for you. I'm so thankful for the way that you've shown up in this season. It looks like exploring a new restaurant, a new city, a new hike with a friend. It looks like playing with others. But what does it look like to enter into the affliction of others? It could look like sitting with someone in their grief. It could look like being a listening ear as someone sharing about their suffering. It could look like suffering or comforting someone as they navigate through depression. It could look like stepping in to meet someone's need. You know, this is not just a ministry plug. This is why I think when we do outreach events like Mobilize Love, it's a cool way to actually snap us out of ourselves and to enter into this life that Jesus is talking about. And so my challenge to you is this. Why not start this week? Who can you join in their joy? Who can you buy a meal, raise a toast with, write a note to, or recognize this week? Who can you join in their tears? Who could use some comfort, some solidarity, some sitting beside in silence? Beloved, life is awaiting for us on the edges. And I believe the challenge of the Spirit this morning is to disrupt our agendas, to move out of the middle and to run toward the edges where Jesus is. Why don't we pray? Holy Spirit, we thank you that you're here. We thank you that you're moving. We thank you that you're not unfamiliar with what we're experiencing. You're not unfamiliar with the temptation of being in the middle. You're not unfamiliar with everything that comes against us in this life. But as you ran toward the edges, as you ran toward beauty and toward affliction, not just within yourself, but even in others, that's the life that you have promised us. That's the fruit of the life that you have said is ours. So today, we want to make space. Right now, would you bring to our minds ways that we can move out of the middle and run toward the edges? For some of us, it might look like creating space for joy and delight because we're working all the time. For some of us, it might mean creating a space where I could finally sit with my emotions. For some of us, it might look like running to celebrate someone else or thank someone for their presence in our lives. It might look like us running to be a listening ear to someone that we love. Whatever it might be, would you move us out of the middle toward life on the edge? Would you speak to us right now about how you could do that?